It has been said that Agatha never fully mastered spelling or grammar because of her unorthodox introduction to words. But this is an exaggeration. Letters do show her getting the odd word wrong, phenomenon, incommoded, megalomania, but her detective fiction shows her as something of a stickler for good usage. "It's me," said Miss Marple, for once ungrammatical. In fact, Agatha learned some grammar at a ladylike establishment in Torquay, run by a Miss Gaia, which she attended 2 days a week from the age of about 13. The decision not to send her to full-time school was quite normal, although it was odd that she had no governess. Perhaps Clara, who knew full well the extent of Agatha's daughterly devotion, preferred to keep it all to herself. Perhaps her attempt to stop Agatha reading was a means of control. Or perhaps she simply wanted to try something different from what had been done with her elder daughter. It was unusual that Madge should have gone away to school, and when it was suggested that she was Girton material, Frederick put his gentlemanly foot down. "She's got Girton written all over her," is an insult delivered in Mary Westmacott's The Burden. Agatha, by contrast, received outside tuition only in music. Her father and Madge taught her to write, and her mother flashed through the more interesting episodes in history. Aside from that, she was on her own. It was probably the making of her. Agatha was one of those autodidacts who go on learning and reading all their lives, and whose minds therefore develop in a way most suitable to them. As an adult, she had an avowed respect for academic brains. Her second husband, Max Mallowan, was an Oxford-educated archaeologist with a knowledge of the classics, and she admired him and his friends for that. Nevertheless, she had an innate confidence in her own, less orthodox thought paths. Her collection of short stories, The Labours of Hercules, recasts the 12 myths in what she would smilingly have called low-brow form, as stories for her own Hercule Poirot to solve. The Nemean lion, for instance, is a kidnapped Pekingese lapdog. Meanwhile, Poirot puts an irreverent, clear-eyed spin upon Greek mythology. "Take this Hercules, this hero." Hero, indeed. What was he but a large, muscular creature of low intelligence and criminal tendencies? The whole classical pattern shocked him. These gods and goddesses, they seem to have as many different aliases as a modern criminal. Indeed, they seem to be definitely criminal types. Drink, debauchery, incest, rape, loot, homicide, and chicanery. Enough to keep a juge d'instruction constantly busy. No decent family life, no order, no method. These were not the definitive opinions of Agatha herself, but she would have been happy to entertain them. Having never been taught, she had no hang-ups about learning. So her mind ran free, and because it was a good mind, it began the process of creative absorption. The worlds of Ashfield, of Torquay, of family, servants, social ritual, of the mysteries that lay beyond, like the stealthy blue of the sea in the distance. As a child, she was protected by structure and certainty. She lived in what W.H. Auden described as the perfect ending place for detective fiction, the state of grace in which the aesthetic and the ethical are as one. Goodness was all around, in the love of her parents and of God, whom she took very seriously, so seriously that she feared for the soul of a father who played croquet in the garden on Sundays. And the running of her home was so efficient and seemly that it acquired a kind of morality. Servants, she was honest enough always to acknowledge, made a state of grace easier to attain. Without Nursey, Jane the cook, and the various maids, Ashfield could not have had its atmosphere of ordered leisure. Jane in particular was immutable and magnificent. She cooked for parties of 8 or more on a regular basis, showing no signs of agitation, except a slight flush. Agatha would skip around, in the hope of a handful of raisins or a rock cake, crisp and steaming and straight from the oven. Never since have I tasted rock cakes like Jane's. Food was the anchor that held daily life in place. A midday Sunday lunch for the family would consist of an enormous Sunday joint, usually cherry tart and cream, a vast piece of cheese, and finally dessert on the best Sunday dessert plates. A menu of a dinner party for 10 began with a choice of thick or clear soup, then boiled turbot or fillets of sole. After that came a sorbet. Saddle of mutton followed. Then, rather unexpectedly, lobster mayonnaise, pudding diplomatique, and Charlotte Russe were the sweets, and then dessert. All of this was produced by Jane single-handed. Agatha ate hugely always, but remained very thin until her 30s. The servants were the architects of Ashfield. They wove the stuff of daily life for Agatha, and they were, she says in her autobiography, its most colourful part. One of the things I think I should miss most, if I were a child nowadays, would be the absence of servants. The modern world cannot begin to comprehend her attitude towards them, which was free of all guilt and doubt. They knew their place, as was said, but knowing their place meant not subservience, but pride, the pride of the professional. A good servant was a person of real standing. I always wonder why people think it's so humiliating to go into service, and that it's grand and independent to be in a shop. One puts up with far more insolence in a shop than any decent domestic does, says Midge, a character in The Hollow, who is obliged to earn her living selling clothes. Agatha thought that she herself would make a good parlourmaid. Being tall was an asset. At one point, she considered doing so, when she was travelling the world with her husband Archie, and money was very short. Bad servants, however, received no respect. When a parlourmaid could not do her job, she was described as a mere mess of adenoids and dropped H's. This d'autant-bain attitude is one of the things that has caused Agatha Christie's reputation to suffer in recent years. "Wonderful animal, the good servant," says a character in And Then There Were None, with a casual, admiring contempt, and our liberal hearts flutter like nervous old ladies. But it was not quite that simple. For example, the frightened rabbit Gladys in A Pocketful of Rye, apparently one of the worst examples of Agatha's lazy snobbery, is actually at the heart of the story, crucial to the plot, and treated with real compassion. "Life is cruel, I'm afraid," says Miss Marple. "One doesn't really know what to do with the Gladyses. They enjoy going to the pictures and all that, but they're always thinking of impossible things that can't possibly happen to them. Perhaps that's a happiness of a kind, but they get disappointed." This is wise and true, and yet, because of the stereotype that Agatha herself has created, we dismiss it as condescension, and Gladys along with it. As she would often do, Agatha has used the familiarity of the stereotype to subvert our expectations. It was one of the cleverest tricks she would play. It was, in fact, more than a trick. By such sudden means, she revealed her insight, her lightly worn understanding of human nature. In A Pocketful of Rye, Miss Marple knows, it is stronger than a guess, the time of Gladys's death, because had she been alive, she would certainly have taken the second tea tray into the drawing room. Thus, an oblique tribute is paid to the importance of servants, to the structure they created in Agatha's life and in her detective fiction. All her life, she was fascinated by the ordering of a home. In her 1957 book, 450 from Paddington, she created a character called Lucy Aylesbarrow, an Oxford graduate who becomes a rich woman by turning herself into the ideal servant. Lucy, with time on her hands, scrubbed the kitchen table, which she had been longing to do. Then she cleaned the silver till it shone radiantly. She cooked lunch, cleared it away, washed it up. She had set out the tea things ready on a tray with sandwiches and bread and butter covered with a damp napkin to keep them moist. It is a litany, a hymn to crisp and shining ritual, a fantasy in which the familiar becomes sublime. The loss of servants post-war changed the nature of Agatha's world. Her books became less regulated, not necessarily a criticism, and there is a continual plangent refrain of how different things are now that there are no servants. Just a couple of women who come in. The modern reaction to this can be imagined. There are plenty of servants today, but few people as honest as Agatha in their attitude towards them. Again, though, her views are a little more complex, at any rate when she wants them to be. For example, The Hollow has a character named David Anketell, a young man full of left-wing disgust for his privileged family. In an entrancingly succinct scene, he spouts politics at Midge, telling her that she would understand the class struggle better if she were a worker. "I am a worker. That's just why being comfortable is so attractive. Box beds, down pillows, early morning tea softly deposited by the bed, a porcelain bath with lashings of hot water and delicious bath salts. The kind of easy chair you really sink into." Midge paused in her catalogue. "The workers," said David, "should have all these things." "I couldn't agree with you more," said Midge heartily. But the child Agatha was safe within order, and order delighted her. She loved the calm bustle of the kitchen and the starch in her muslin dresses almost as much as she loved to dream of the glistening river at the end of Ashfield's garden, towards which she would ride on a white palfrey. Later, she loved Lucy Islesbarrow, mundane and magical, waving her scrubbing brush like a wand as she turned a house into a place of regulated beauty. For all the wanderings of her imagination, Agatha was fascinated always by the power of the ordinary. She grew up with ordinary female conversation in her ears, and this, too, delighted her. She picked out phrases almost as if they were music, catching something of their meaning but loving far more the way they danced in her head. "I haven't yet finished, Florence." "I beg your pardon, Mrs. Rowe," was what she had heard in the kitchen when a servant rose from the tea table before Jane had finished her meal. She remembered the little interchange all her life. She liked to listen to the ladylike squabbles between Margaret Miller and Mary Ann Beamer, whom she always described as her grandmothers, although Margaret was in fact her great-aunt.
"Nonsense, Margaret, I never heard such nonsense in my life."
"Indeed, Mary, let me tell you." She particularly liked the subtleties that bristled upon Margaret's comfortable pronouncements.
"Such a nice woman. Colonel L. is an old friend of her husband who asked him to look after her. There is, of course, nothing wrong about that. Everybody knows that."
She stored these phrases away just as Margaret, in her home at Ealing, packed her cupboards with dates, preserved fruits, figs, French plums, cherries, angelica, packets of raisins and currants, pounds of butter and sacks of sugar, tea and flour, her bedroom trunks with rich velvets and silks. When her parents went travelling together, Clara thought it her duty to be with Frederick, Agatha would visit the large house to which Margaret, Auntie Granny, had moved from Cheshire as a prosperous and substantial widow. Mary Ann, or Granny B, lived in Bayswater. There was a deep history between these two sisters. They were close companions in their old age, both stout, proud figures in their tight-wrapped black silk, but the difference in status was apparent. Margaret was the more assured, Mary Ann her foil. Margaret helped her sister with sums of money given in return for errands carried out at the Army and Navy stores in Victoria. Back to Ealing, Mary Ann would go with various buttons and ribbons and lengths of material, all of which would be rigorously judged and discussed and paid for out of Margaret's bulging purse, whose innards gleamed with gold. As Agatha wrote in her autobiography, the sisters regarded the Army and Navy stores as the hub of the universe. Occasionally she accompanied them there, and in At Bertram's Hotel, a book written in her own old age, she has Miss Marple recollect the scene.
Miss Marple cast her thoughts back to Aunt Helen, seeking out her own special man in the grocery department, settling herself comfortably in a chair, wearing a bonnet and what she always called her black poplin mantle. Then there would ensue a long hour with nobody in a hurry, and Aunt Helen thinking of every conceivable grocery that could be purchased and stored up for future use. Having had a thoroughly pleasant morning, Aunt Helen would say in the playful manner of those times, "And how would a little girl feel about some luncheon?" After that, they bought 0.5 pound of coffee creams and went to a matinee in a four-wheeler. These performances, which to her is what they were, satisfied a desire in Agatha. They embodied a kind of robust feminine certainty, the human equivalent of the ordered home. She had had a version of this with Nursie. After Nurse, there was God. Although Nursie dealt with Agatha as a child, and lacked, therefore, the worldly dimension. Clara, meanwhile, was too creative and mercurial to have, as Margaret Miller did, a wonderful womanly instinct that never doubted itself. Always think the worst about people. Gentlemen need attention and 3 proper meals a day. Never get into a train with a single man. Waste not, want not. Gentlemen like a figure. Every woman should have £50 in 5-pound notes in case of emergencies. Gentlemen can be very agreeable, but you can't trust one of them. Thus did Margaret express herself as she sat erect and dauntless among the heavy mahogany furniture at Ealing, whispering advice to Clara. A husband should never be left alone too long. Dealing with a young man who has impregnated a servant. Well, are you going to do the right thing by Harriet? Chatting to her men friends among the tea things. I hope your wife won't object. I shouldn't like to cause trouble. Her strong, sane voice dealt in mysteries, rendering them murky and cozy. Irresistible to Agatha. These rhythmic phrases belonged to a world as different as could be from the palfrey and the gleaming river. But they had, nonetheless, their own beauty. She never repeated anything she heard, however interesting, and in this she was quite unlike the rest of my family, who were all extrovert talkers. Instead, she listened to everything, absorbing it. Not understanding it, perhaps never fully understanding it at all, letting it form a pattern in her mind. One day, the Miss Marple who had sat with her Aunt Helen in the Army and Navy stores would become a version of that aunt. Wise, compassionate, unflinching from reality. This was not Agatha. She did flinch. Like most real writers, she was a stronger person in her books than in her life. She had a constant urge to recreate the women of her childhood, the faith she had in their comforting omniscience. Miss Marple is the supreme example, and there are others like Miss Pursehouse in the Sittaford Mystery, "I hate a slobbering female," or Miss Peabody in Dumb Witness, "not the sort of young man I'd fancy if I were a young girl." Well, Teresa should know her mind. She's had her experiences, I'll be bound. Also, Dame Laura Whitstable, in the Westmacott novel A Daughter's a Daughter, who is not so much a character as a magnificent mouthpiece. Her real reason for existing in the book is the pleasure that Agatha takes in her. "I'm old-fashioned," she says, puffing at a cigar. "I would prefer that a man should have knowledge of himself and belief in God. Nobody can really ruin another person's life. Don't be melodramatic and don't wallow. Half the troubles in life come from pretending to oneself that one is a better and finer human being than one is. The fewer people who love you, the less you will have to suffer." Nobody talks the way Dame Laura talks, yet she has artistic reality, because to Agatha she is real. She is the authentic spirit of female certainty, speaking the thoughts of her creator in a voice that Agatha always needed to hear. Agatha grew up in a matriarchy. The strength was all on the female side. Clara, Margaret, clever sister Madge, Nursie, Jane the cook. Her father and brother, never stood a chance. Frederick didn't mind a jot about this. Monty undoubtedly did. Agatha was never a feminist, but she knew perfectly well the value of women, which she considered feminism helped to devalue, as shown in an interview she gave to an Italian magazine in 1962. How, she was asked, had it happened that women now played a more active role in public life? Her answer is not what had been expected. Probably due to the foolishness of women in relinquishing their position of privilege attained after many centuries of civilization. Primitive women toil incessantly. We seem determined to return to that state voluntarily, or by listening to persuasion and therefore forfeiting the joys of leisure and creative thought, and the perfecting of home conditions. Agatha believed that femaleness had its own power, entirely separate from the male. Surely, we are the privileged sex. Yet as on most subjects, her beliefs were fluid, complex, honestly uncertain. In her detective novel set in ancient Egypt, Death Comes as the End, she wrote of the rich, varied noises of the kitchen, the high, shrill note of Issa's voice, the strident tones of Satipi, and, very faintly, the deeper, persistent contralto of Kate. A babel of women's voices, chattering, laughing, complaining, scolding, exclaiming. And suddenly, Renesembe felt stifled, encircled by this persistent and clamorous femininity. Women, noisy, vociferous women. A houseful of women, never quiet, never peaceful, always talking, exclaiming, saying things, not doing them. And Kai silent and watchful in his boat, his whole mind bent on the fish he was going to spear. Female life in this book is seen as something powerful. What are men anyway? They are necessary to breed children, that is all. But the strength of the race is in the women, says Kate. But also limited and limiting. There is another, more difficult kind of happiness to be found, when a woman can grow up and still touch her own childlike simplicity. Renesembe had got into the habit of going up to the tomb almost every day. She would sit in the shade of the rock chamber entrance with one knee raised and her hands clasped round it, and stare out over the green belt of cultivation to where the Nile showed a pale gleaming blue, and beyond it to a distance of pale soft fawns and creams and pinks, all melting hazily into each other. When Agatha travelled to the east, as she did with her second husband, she too would look out on transcendent landscapes and find this kind of demanding, almost troubling peace. A return, in a way, to what she had found years before when she had seen other worlds in the garden at Ashfield. "You are lucky, Renesembe," says her wild old grandmother Issa. "You have found the happiness that is inside everybody's own heart." To most women, happiness means coming and going, busied over small affairs. It is made up of small things strung together like beads on a string. To Clara, the woman to whom Agatha was always closest, happiness was an elusive thing. She loved her home, although she was too restless to find absolute contentment in it. She sought artistic outlets for what were, in fact, indifferent artistic talents. Even her embroidery was inept. Her spiritualism was both profound and unsettled, as if she felt its importance but did not quite know what to do with it. She cast around with different religions, seriously considering conversion to Roman Catholicism, and flirting with Unitarianism, Christian Science, and Zoroastrianism. She did find happiness in her family. The depths of her adoration were not always answered by Frederick's calm, gentlemanly, uxorous smiles. Monty was difficult, but Madge and Agatha were exceptional girls, whose creativity gave an outlet to Clara's own. It was her youngest daughter, though, with whom Clara had her strongest bond. As Agatha was to write in Unfinished Portrait, she had inherited something from her mother. a dangerous intensity of affection. For a time, Agatha and Clara would be the sole recipients of each other's devotion. "Receipts for Agatha," it says, in Clara's rounded, well-schooled handwriting on the first page of an exercise book. "Poulard à la crème. Choose a good fat pullet. Eggs à la Monte Cristo. Mushrooms à la Henri IV. Granny's plum pudding. Salad dressing. 2 yolks of hard-boiled eggs made into a smooth paste. Add a teaspoonful of made mustard and also of salt, a few grains of cayenne pepper. Then a teaspoonful of vinegar. To this, add 2 tablespoonsful of best oil. Then after mixing, put in 2 tablespoonsful of cream. Friday night. Sole, roast pigeons, fried potatoes and salad, cherry tart, cream." What dreams for Agatha lay within these painstakingly copied recipes? What visions of a perfect life, as ordered and kindly as childhood? 100 years on, the exercise book in which they were written lay upstairs at Greenway House, in what had been Agatha's bedroom, in a tall and handsome chest of drawers. A green leather case embossed with the name Clarissa Miller contained the book of recipes, with many other things. A wallet made of gold-colored material embroidered "To Frederick from Clarissa," containing a dollar bill. A purse embroidered with the entwined initials F and C, and the line, "Set me as a seal upon thine heart, for love is strong as death." An envelope containing a piece of Pear's soap used by Frederick, still faintly fragrant. Clara's album of poems. Pieces of Edelweiss kept from her honeymoon in Switzerland, crumbling within the pages of a letter to FAM. Her marriage certificate. A green wallet containing letters. A program for the 1894 Harrow School Speech Day. A picture of Agatha as a child sitting on a wicker bench under a little palm tree. A picture of Frederick as a boy looking like Agatha. A picture of Clara herself wearing an embroidered robe at the dinner table at Ashfield. A letter to Agatha sent from Ealing. "My darling wee Babsy, I'm sure you must be very cold with so much snow about Ashfield. Darling little girlie, Mother is longing to kiss and love her sweet pea again. Auntie Granny sends you much love. Tell Jane to please get a partridge to make you some potted meat for tea or breakfast." A letter from Madge in London to Agatha. "My dear little chicken, how are you getting on? I hope you are conducting yourself in a highly respectable way and not forgetting me." A letter from Frederick to Agatha in Ealing, dated 15th of June, 1894. "I am longing so much to see you and dear Mother again. Ashfield is looking very lovely, and I think you will find your room nice and pretty with new furniture and paper. Scott looks very miserable when I talk about you, and seems to say to me, 'Will my dear little mistress never come back?' I do miss my walks with her and nurse so much. I hear your granny is going to have your picture painted. I think it is a most lovely idea, and I want you to put your little arms around granny's neck and give her a hug and kiss for me. You must always be good and gentle to her, and I am pleased to think you are." So many things kept, so many passions folded into papers, so strong the desire to hold memory within envelopes and miniature boxes and embossed cases. Every separate thing inside the case held still the breath of the instinct that had been moved to keep it. There were other things, too, in the cupboards and drawers of Greenway. Christening gowns like heaps of soft snow, birth certificates, Clara born in Belfast, Agatha born at Ashfield, Agatha's daughter Rosalind born at Ashfield. A framed menu of Clara and Frederick's Déjeuner du Mariage. Palace Gardens Terrace, 11th of April, 1878. A bill dated 17th of June, 1940. Sale of Ashfield, Barton Road, Torquay. £2,400. Furniture and fittings, £21.19 and sixpence. box after box of photographs. Ashfield, Primstead Farm, the childhood home of Margaret and Mary Ann. Clara, with Agatha's little dog Tony. Margaret Miller, seated imperiously in a three-wheeler. Monty, dressed in coachman's regalia, sitting behind a harnessed goat in True Love's a toy cart. Teenage Madge, in her long skirt, her smile clever and confident. Agatha and a friend, aged around 7, peeping charmingly over the backs of the raffia chairs in the garden. A white fan, still in its long slim case, given by Frederick to Margaret. A scrapbook that belonged to Madge, in which she had stuck some of her dance cards and cutouts of carriages full of flowers. Switzerland, 1878. Souvenir of Mother's Wedding Journey. Clara's copy of The Imitation of Christ by Thomas a Kempis, on whose flyleaf Agatha had written, "Who shall separate us from the love of Christ?" And in another leather case, an Album of Confession, in which every member of the family wrote their replies to a list of questions. Favourite virtue, favourite colour, heroes, heroines, present state of mind, and so on. Imagination works easily upon this book. Its thin pages, scratched with slanted writing, conjure the Millers in the drawing-room at Ashfield. One sees them through the tall windows that stretch down to the garden, sitting within their magically enclosed world, fir cones burning cleanly on the fire as they sipped cherry brandy and pondered their answers. The women of the family, sincere, high-minded, played the confession game very seriously. In 1871, Margaret Miller wrote that her favourite virtue was self-denial. Her chief characteristic was obstinacy, and to the question, "If not yourself, who would you be?" her reply was, "A better individual." Mary Ann Beamer refused to be drawn on this question. "I envy no one." She named her chief characteristic as want of caution, and her present state of mind as anxious. Her idea of misery was to be in debt. Her hero, she wrote carefully, was Nathaniel Frary Miller, the brother-in-law whose money had paid for Clara's upbringing. Meanwhile, Clara, then 17, described her present state of mind as wishing for a long dress, although she would have had no occasion to wear it, since despite her wealth, Margaret had no plans to give her adopted daughter a social season. Perhaps Clara was aiming an oblique shaft at her aunt and mother when she wrote that her chief characteristic was a great love for children. Her idea of happiness was always doing the thing that is right. The fault for which she had most tolerance was reserve. Her own lies heavy on the page. What godly creatures these women were, and how Victorian their tastes, their love of Mendelssohn, Landseer, Prince Albert, and Miss Nightingale, their dislike of deceit and affectation. Naturally, Frederick took the game far more lightly. In 1872 he wrote, perhaps with a cousinly wink at Clara, that his chief characteristic was doing nothing, and his pet aversion, getting up in the morning. Present state of mind? Extremely comfortable, thank you. Agatha first played the confessions game at the age of 7. Some of her answers were absolutely her own. Her pet aversion was bedtime when you are wide awake. If not herself, she would be a fairy. But her heavy eyes were in search of approval when she wrote that her idea of happiness was to be good, that her hero and heroine were father and mother, her favourite painter, the family portraitist, Baird. She meant these things, of course. Nevertheless, this was the public Agatha, who kept something of her real self withheld, a little girl who sought to please and draw loving nods from those around her. A serious little girl, as she wrote in Unfinished Portrait, who thought a good deal about God and being good and holy. Alas, undoubtedly a prig. Agatha was being hard on herself, but perhaps she knew that her childish religiosity was not wholly real. It was essential to her dream world that she be clean in clothes and soul. She liked to see herself as a good girl a character in a Victorian novel with her sashed waist and her hoop and her book of Bible stories by the bed. She liked to believe in duty. Such were the times in which she lived, the milieu in which she was raised. But it was also her nature. Her imaginative wanderings were always in the land of virtue. Morality, security, and happiness were all bound up together. If Agatha was good, she would be safe. If she was safe, she would be happy. All of which she was, heartbreakingly so because it could not last. The sweet structures of her life protected her too much. She was wrapped as carefully and precariously as Clara's Edelweiss flowers. Somewhere inside herself, she knew this, even at 7. Her happiness was complete. Yet she wrote in her confession that her idea of misery was for someone I love to go away from me. She had suffered then when her parents went on their little holidays to New York. Home with Mummy in it. Oh, Mummy, Mummy. And she dreamed regularly about evil. In the gunman nightmare, places that Agatha knew and loved, like the tea table at Ashfield, were invaded by a spectre with a murderer's eyes and no hands. At first, the gunman was a person in his own right. He wore a French uniform and had powdered hair in a queue. Then the dream changed. It would be a happy dream, a picnic or a party, she wrote in Unfinished Portrait. And suddenly, just when you were having lots of fun, a queer feeling crept over you. Something was wrong somewhere. What is it? Why, of course, the gunman was there. But he wasn't himself. One of the guests was the gunman. And the awful part of it was, he might be anybody. It might be Mummy or Daddy or Nanny, someone you were just talking to. You looked up in Mummy's face. Of course it was Mummy, and then you saw the light, steely blue eyes. And from the sleeve of Mummy's dress, oh, horror, that horrible stump. It wasn't Mummy. It was the gunman. Agatha was 11 when her father died at his stepmother's house in Ealing. A hospital nurse came out and spoke to Granny, who was coming up the stairs. It's all over, she said. In the green wallet inside her leather case, Clara kept the letters sent and received in the year of her husband's death. Darling Daddy, I am so sorry you are still ill. We miss you very much. Agatha had written to him at the start of 1901. I had a nice afternoon as Jane let me make cakes in the kitchen. I made some with sultanas and some with ginger. I had Devonshire cream for tea. In May, Clara went to Ealing with Agatha, who had not been well. Frederick himself was by then very ill indeed. But like the true gentleman he was, he turned his thoughts outward. I was very much distressed to learn by your letter this morning that Agatha was not doing as well as you could wish. Madge is having 10 girls for ping-pong tomorrow. She is quite proud of this. I still keep all right. Meanwhile, throughout 1901, he was keeping a list of heart attacks. He recorded 30 between June and September. Slight attack, good night, was a typical entry. Clara may not have seen this list until after her husband's death, as he would not have wanted to worry her. In October he wrote from his club, the Wyndham, in St. James Square, to tell her about a visit to a specialist in London. I saw Sansom this morning, and he told me very much the same thing as last time. He insists that my trouble has more to do with the nerves of the heart than anything else. I have felt wonderfully better the last 2 days. I am now, please God, done with doctors. Which was true in a sense. A month later, Frederick was dead. He was 55 and had been staying in Ealing to be close to London, where he had intended to look for a job. Financial concerns, so long dismissed, had played their part in his early death. His heart and his fortunes weakened together, and he had not a clue what to do about it. I have had no letter from America since my return, which I try to think is good news, he wrote to Clara. By that time, there was nothing to do but endure the knowledge of the New York properties that cost so much more to keep than they earned in rent, of the trustee who had gone into an asylum, of the other trustee who had shot himself, of the lurking suspicion of embezzlement. Back in 1896, when the nature of the crisis first became apparent to him, Frederick had taken action of sorts. He had let Ashfield with its servants and moved with his wife and daughters to France for a year. This was a familiar economy made by the straitened gentry. Different things were cheap in those days. To stay in hotels on the continent cost less than it did to run a big house in England, and one could always take letters of introduction to ensure a social life. For the first 6 months, the Millers stayed in Pau, considered healthful with its clear mountain air. They went on to Cauterets, also in the Pyrenees, then to Paris, and finally to Brittany. Agatha was too excited by the experience to miss Ashfield. Anyway, she was always happy in the company of her mother. She did not, though, live an imaginative life in France. From the moment of her arrival, she felt a certain disappointment that there was a world much like any other. Having longed to see mountains, she was hit by a disillusionment I have never forgotten. Where was that soaring height going up, up, up into the sky, far above my head? Something beyond contemplation or understanding. So she lived contentedly in the realm of reality for the first time in her 7 years, behaving like any other normal, lively little girl. She made friends easily and discovered the joys of mischief, playing tricks on other hotel guests, like hiding under the stairs with a peacock feather and tickling people's legs as they passed. She learned to swim, a lifelong pleasure. She watched the sexual blossoming of her sister Madge, had a crush on a saturnine lift boy, and yearned for the day when she would fill out a striped blouse and collar and tie. She grew fond of the young Marie Siege, whom Clara had whisked from her job at a dressmaker's to become Agatha's companion and French conversationalist. Like most of Clara's instinctive decisions, this was a success. Agatha had no conscious sense of the reasons behind the family's removal to France, but Unfinished Portrait shows that she had understood more than she realized at the time. There is a scene in the book in which her parents meet friends from England, the Grants, at a hotel in Pau. Celia overheard Mr. Grant say to her mother, "It gave me a shock to see old John, Frederick, but he tells me he is ever so much fitter since being here." Celia said to her mother afterwards, "Mummy, is Daddy ill?" Her mother looked a little queer as she answered, "No, no, of course not. He's perfectly well now. It was just the damp and rain in England." Celia was glad her father wasn't ill. Not, she thought, that he could be. He never went to bed or sneezed or had a bilious attack. He coughed sometimes, but that was because he smoked so much. Celia knew that, because her father told her so. France was a help to Frederick. Nevertheless, the years of content were over for him. In the album of confession, he had written that his idea of misery was consciousness of guilt, and he may therefore have suffered to know that he was leaving his beloved family with so little money, that he had let it all go through his gentlemanly negligence, that Clara would be forced to sell the Chippendales and Sheratons bought with such smiling abandon, that probably Ashfield itself would have to be sold. Yet he would have been comforted by the fact that there was no reproach in Clara's nature. She had viewed it as happiness beyond prize to be married to Frederick. In the confessions, he too had described his idea of happiness, which was to be perfectly loved. Many people might wish for this, but for Frederick, the wish had been granted, and he knew it. "No man ever had a wife like you," he wrote to Clara shortly before the end. More than 100 years on, this letter was still in her leather case, with the order of service from Frederick's funeral and leaves from trees in the cemetery at Ealing, where he was buried. "I see thee not, dear heart, and yet I see, as though mine eyes drew solace from thy face. Clara had written on the envelope, containing the last piece of Pear's soap her husband had used. From then on, until Clara's death 25 years later, Agatha would be the heart of her mother's life. "You've got to live for your children, remember, my dear," said the nurse who had looked after Frederick at Ealing, and who tended afterwards to Clara. "Yes, I've got to live for my children. You needn't tell me that, I know it." But it was really Agatha for whom she now lived. Madge was soon to be married. Monty was abroad with his regiment. And anyway, Agatha had always been special to Clara. Her inexpressive depth of emotion, her secretive imagination, her heavy, adoring eyes, her serene confidence in the love that, nonetheless, she constantly sought. Like Clara, she had understood the fear of loss, although she had never experienced it until Frederick's death. And so it was with Agatha that Clara made the bond she had never had with her own mother. The closeness between the two became as powerful as electricity. It was the light within Agatha, and in later years it would sometimes blind her. "My grandmother was a dangerous woman," said Agatha's daughter Rosalind many years later. "Strong and dangerous. My mother never thought she was wrong." The death of her father did not mean the end of Agatha's idyll. In Unfinished Portrait, she is sent a letter by each of her parents when they are abroad, and she is staying with her grandmother at Ealing. "Two lovely, lovely letters," she writes. But it is her mother's that causes her agony. Home. She wanted to go home. Home with Mimi in it. Although Agatha had loved her father dearly, so long as she was with Clara she could be happy without him. But until he died, she had known only control and decorum. Suddenly, for a time, her life became unstable. "I stepped out of my child's world to enter the fringes of the world of reality." She glimpsed raw and fearful things. Like a good Victorian girl, she went to her mother's bedside to tell her that Father was happy now in heaven. Clara wouldn't want him to have to leave paradise, would she? "Yes, I would. I would do anything in the world to have him back. Anything, anything at all. I want him back here, now, in this world, with me." Clara was wild with grief, so much so that she too became ill. Her heart was weakened. She slept with Sal Volatile beside her, and for a year or so, Agatha would stand outside her bedroom door at night, listening for her breathing, sometimes waiting for hours until she heard a sound. In her kind but unimaginative way, Margaret Miller tried to share with Clara her own grief for her stepson. Unfinished Portrait shows her reading letters of condolence at the breakfast table. "Mr. Clark is a truly good man," she would say, sniffing a little as she read. "Miriam, you really should hear this. It would help you. He speaks so beautifully of how our dead are always with us." And suddenly roused from her quiescence, Miriam would cry out, "No, no!" It was the last thing that Clara wanted. Frederick was hers and hers alone. "I could gladly die for thee," she had written to him in 1877. How could Margaret understand that she had meant exactly that? His removal from within the family had taken away its essential balance. The civilized, easy presence within that knot of complex women. All her life, Clara had had to be grateful to Margaret. "I'm sure you are very, very happy with dear Granny," she wrote to Agatha at Ealing in 1897. "Dear little Agatha, what a happy home you have with darling Granny. You must be good to her and love her very much." But Clara did not love Margaret. Margaret had never really loved Clara. And with Frederick gone, the matriarchy was laid briefly, angrily bare. Clara's resentments slid out, towards both the mother who had given her away and the aunt who had offered to take her. Celia wondered whether Granny really liked Mummy and whether Mummy really liked Granny. She didn't quite know what put the idea into her head. This was the real aftermath of death, a confused stir of emotions that were not necessarily to do with grief. Adult emotions, ambivalent and irrational. No wonder Agatha retreated to the world of her imagination and created a new world for herself. The school, attended by the girls. First, there was Ethelred Smith, who was tall and dark and very, very clever. Then there was Annie Brown, Ethel's great friend. Isabella Sullivan, who had red hair and brown eyes, and was beautiful. She was rich and proud and unpleasant. She always thought that she was going to beat Ethel at croquet, but Celia saw to it that she didn't, though she felt rather mean sometimes when she deliberately made Isabella miss balls. Among the seven girls, there was one who refused to take on reality for Agatha. This was Sue de Vert, fair-haired with pale blue eyes, curiously colourless in character. While the other girls chattered, engaged with each other, had definite pasts and futures, Elsie Green had grown up terribly poor, Sue's sister Vera de Vert was to become one of the world's greatest beauties, Sue remained the observer. In old age, Agatha still thought occasionally of the girls. Even now, sometimes, as I put away a dress in a cupboard, I say to myself, yes, that would do well for Elsie. Green was always her colour. It makes me laugh when I do it. But there the girls are still, though unlike me, they have not grown old.